From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. President Trump disclosed that he had offered China's President Xi Jinping to be, quote, flexible, unquote, in trade talks if China will crack down on North Korea and its nuclear weapons program. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met in Moscow with Russian leader Vladimir Putin as Trump, in Washington, said relations with Russia may be at an all-time low. Trump also reversed his view that NATO, the North American Treaty Organization, is, quote, obsolete, unquote, and said he has not demanded that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad step down. Well, we heard a lot from President Trump on foreign policy issues, Barbara, and I just want to start with this question because you've been following presidents on foreign policy for many years, probably more closely than I have. And has a president ever disclosed exactly what offers he made in private discussions with foreign leaders the way Trump has?
Well, look, everything about Trump's presidency has been unprecedented. Some would say unprecedented, but certainly unprecedented. He's a very garrulous, transactional guy. He obviously had a good time meeting with Xi Jinping in Mar-a-Lago, and he wants to tell everyone how well they got along and, you know, describe some of the horse trading that's going on.
It's the horse trading that surprises me.
Yeah,
you usually don't hear that from the president who just emerged from private meetings.
But we have to look at his background and, you know, as a real estate guy, as somebody who sells his name, his trademark, and so on. These are the kinds of things that he does. I mean, it remains to be seen how effective it will be. But I do have to say that the Chinese, at least catering to this or flattering him in some way, have adopted a harsher tone toward North Korea. And I don't know if it's because Trump has now decided not to call them a currency manipulator, which was another threat that he had made, or because they see some concern that if North Korea continues down the path it's been on, that Trump could do something military that would really destabilize the situation.
Mm-hmm. Michael, what do you think about a president like this? Barbara says, you know, it is, Trump is unique in many, many ways. This is one that I think he's very unique in.
Yeah, I believe Barbara used the word transactional in her description. I think that's really a perfect description for him. He is at his core still a businessman, a negotiator. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways you do that is to get those negotiations into the public arena. And so he's thinking not only in terms of his policy, he's always thinking politically and, you know, appealing to the people who, quote unquote, like him. So I think there's to get some reinforcement that, hey, I am doing the right thing. He wants to hear back. He's in the echo chamber and wants to hear back. Did I do good? Yes, I did. And that's affirmation to go forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did see a reversal. And I imagine that we'll be talking a lot over the next half hour about the reversals. that have been made. But the reversal.
I'm going to leave that to you all.
Well, China went from being in the space of a slice of chocolate cake, it went to be the worst currency manipulator in the history of currency and manipulation, to being a great friend and an ally in working with North Korea. So, look, he's doing the right things. He sat down, he talked to them. It wasn't a horrible meeting. I don't think it's going to change the course of history either, because China is a very savvy operator. They're going to take these things, they're going to go use them, and we'll see what happens the next time they build another outpost in the middle of the South China Sea and build an island out of nothing. What happens then?
And Michael, when the president announces the deal, you know, look, I'll be flexible on trade talks, and if you all lean on the North Koreans, does that put pressure on the Chinese president to actually do what Trump wants him to do in this deal?
No, I don't think it puts any pressure on him at all. I mean, the situation is what it is, no matter what he speaks into a microphone. The situation between the United States and China and China and North Korea, you know, are what they are. And by the way, I think Trump got an education, surprisingly, about the situation, the history of the Korean Peninsula, you know, in a 10-minute briefing from the president of China. I think what he let him know is that, look, China can influence North Korea, but it doesn't control North Korea. This is not, you know, one of the provinces of China. They have some influence. They do not have control. So no matter what he says, the relationships remain as they are.
Does it matter that Trump said that he and the Chinese leader, Barbara, have good chemistry? Does that really matter? I mean,
well,
it's
better
I'm
than the,
it's
better
true,
than the but reverse. But Trump tends to say this about all the people he meets. I mean, he said that after he met President Obama, you know, for the first time after questioning where President Obama had been born for 8 years. Again, it's part of his style, and it's something we all just have to get used to. But we have to see what the concrete results are going to be.
Mm-hmm. What about putting pressure? I asked Michael about putting pressure on China. Mm-hmm. Is this what Trump is trying to do when announcing this?
Partly, and I think we already actually have seen some results. I mean, there was a front page editorial in something called the Global Times where the Chinese basically threatened to start severely limiting oil shipments to North Korea if they take more provocative actions. And we should say, as we're speaking, that North Korea is celebrating the 105th birthday of Kim Il-sung, the founder of the state, and there had been indications and that they would pop off a missile or even another nuclear test, and that may yet occur. But China now, by making these kinds of statements, I think is making it clear that there would be a price to pay. We should also say that there's a lot more that the world can do non-militarily. North Korea still gets missile parts through companies in China. These could be stopped. There could be more stringent sanctions on the financial sector, the kinds of things that were used to put pressure on Iran during those or before those nuclear negotiations could be used much more seriously with North Korea. And, of course, at the same time, the U.S. has sent an aircraft carrier, a whole sort of carrier group up close to North Korea. So it's a combination of threats, cajoling, military pressure, and I think economic pressure that could have some impact. Oh, and agreeing to talk to North Korea, by the way, too. That would also be useful.
Michael, you know, in the past, Republican and Democratic presidents have I would say, tried to appease North Korea, but basically to buy them off so they wouldn't move ahead military with their nuclear program, and the North Koreans would agree, and then they'd break the treaty. And it happened to all presidents. And this seems to be different now with Trump. And I guess my question is the era of appeasement over?
Interesting.
At least temporarily, but
appeasement to get what accomplished, I guess, really is the question. Yeah. What are you really trying to get to? Because at this point, I think the train has left the station in terms of the North Korean nuclear program. They are hell-bent for leather to get those nuclear weapons and to put them on an ICBM. And I'm not sure what you can do to stop it at this point unless you go in with a serious military strike. Then you're calling into question the lives of millions and millions of people in Seoul. I mean, how do you do that?
You could have an agreement for them to freeze that program.
You could.
Right?
You absolutely could. Has that been successful over the course of the last
two or three years? Well, I wanted to disagree with your use of the word appeasement, because the agreed framework of 1994 kept North Korea from developing nuclear weapons, for more than a decade. And it was the George W. Bush administration that walked away from that agreement by stopping deliveries of fuel oil to North Korea in the fall of 2002 after charging the North Koreans with developing a separate uranium enrichment program, which was actually not in the confines of the agreed framework. So let's be historically accurate here. Mm-hmm. It's not appeasement if you get a deal that stops your adversary from developing nuclear weapons for more than a decade. It bought time. Unfortunately, it wasn't continued.
Mm. Okay. Let's turn to relations with Russia. It doesn't. Certainly Trump, who was not the one who actually met with Putin. I don't think he's ever met him, but he's talked to him on the phone a couple times since he's been elected. But his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, did. That really didn't seem like there was a lot of good chemistry there, Barbara.
It was a pretty tense time for Rex Tillerson in Moscow, certainly different from when he used to go there as head of ExxonMobil and would be given various medals by Putin. This has been the most fascinating reversal, frankly, of the Trump administration so far. We were all expecting the bromance between Trump and Putin to continue, and instead we now have something that's very close to the Cold War. It's even more tense in some ways than it was under the Obama administration. The conspiracy theorists out there are saying, well, Trump is just doing this because he doesn't want people to know that he's really in Putin's pocket. And, of course, the investigation into ties between the Trump campaign and Russia continues as we speak. Nevertheless, the break has come over Syria. and the fact that the Russians have defended the actions of Bashar al-Assad, who once again gassed his own people, and Trump woke up and decided that Bashar al-Assad was, quote-unquote, an animal, and that this was a crime against humanity, and sent some cruise missiles to attack the base where these chemical weapons came from. So this is the cause right now of this this big rift between the United States and Russia.
Yeah, Michael, does it really serve Russia's interests to be sticking as it does with Assad, and also claiming that it's not even clear that he had done the attack that killed with sarin gas that killed 85 Syrians, including what, 27 children?
Yeah, with Putin right now, I think Syria is serving as their entry into Middle East politics. This is their proxy now, so they can become involved in that. And they're pretty sold on having them as a partner. There was a UN resolution that was attempted condemning the gas attack, the sarin gas attack, and that was blocked by Russia, mm-hmm. their permanent position on the Security Council, I believe the eighth time they protected Syria from that position. Yeah, I know that they are a committed partner with Syria. And one of the questions I'd always had is why, I keep and looking for this answer of why Syria actually did this. What was the reason, the impetus for them to do this at this time?
Very good question.
And I'm searching for an answer for that, and I can't get that. And I'd love to hear them. You know,
yeah.
Because these are the things. What is the impetus? Because yes, this has caused a serious split. You had at the mm-hmm. beginning of a week, mm-hmm. The Secretary of State saying it's up to the Syrian people whether or not Bashar al-Assad stays in power, and within a week, yeah. he's an animal and must go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a stunning reversal in the 7-day period.
What are your theories on why the Syrians did this?
Bashar al-Assad is not the smartest person in the room. Let's just put it that way. He's done a lot of really stupid and brutal things since he came to power. I think of the assassination of Rafik Hariri in Lebanon is another one. I think he did it for several reasons. He thought he could get away with it because Trump and Tillerson and Nikki Haley had all just said that he didn't have to go as part of an initial settlement in Syria. He did it because his armed forces are really decimated. And he thought that chemical weapons would be a cheap and easy way of terrifying people. And he wants to reclaim control over Idlib province, which is this large province in the northwest of Syria. He's now got Aleppo all the way on down to Damascus. And if he could get Idlib, which is full of rebels who are not ISIS, that would really consolidate his control over what's called useful Syria. So I think those are two of the reasons that he did it. But he's miscalculated hugely once again.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Well, I'm still intrigued by what you talked about, Barbara, the way this our expectations have been flipped. Remember, I mean, Russia, they were supposed to be our partners, and China was going to be a big problem. And it does seem like the opposite has happened rather suddenly.
Yeah, well, I wanted to quote a couple of tweets from our fearless leader. These are really interesting. You know, before the election, everything was doom and gloom. The United States was going to hell, and nobody respected us. Now he tweets, things will work out fine between the USA and Russia. At the right time, everyone will come to their senses, and there will be lasting peace. You know, I was wondering, you know, what's this guy smoking? And then he has another one. I have great confidence that China will properly deal with North Korea. If they are unable to do so, the U.S. with its allies will. USA. Mm-hmm. So those are two tweets from Donald Trump in the last few days. I think he thinks that he's kind of maneuvering once again in a very transactional way, and that, you know, he can come back around and be great friends with Putin. We can agree on something, perhaps. These are tactics, negotiating tactics, perhaps, as much as anything. But in fairness, I think he obviously was shocked by what happened in Syria. This is a man who knows very little about international affairs, who is getting an education on the job in a way that no president we've had, I don't know, maybe and certainly in my memory, has ever had. You know, he is learning the history of the Korean Peninsula. He is learning about chemical weapons and that people use them. You know, so he's also being educated by Gary Cohn, the head of his Council of Economic Advisors, on, you know, why the Export-Import Bank is important for helping American companies to sell things abroad. He's learning a great deal, and I think we should be grateful that he's learning it.
Maybe he's been told, Trump has, that to get rid of the Export-Import Bank, you need a vote of Congress, and the votes aren't there to get rid of it. So
that could be one reason,
Certainly President Bush found that out, the second President Bush. Anyway, I guess I've exhausted the subject of Russia and Syria and so on, but and China, just incredibly fascinating things. What about Trump reversing his view? You wanted to talk about reversals, okay? His view on NATO. Look, there have been many. I'm not. That was not a taunt. That was. This is a question. He has reversed his view on NATO. He doesn't think it's obsolete. And, of course, some of these NATO members are spending a little bit more on defense. I don't think it's been tremendous. So what do you make of this?
Yeah, I heard some great lines this week. Like, there's been more flips in the White House than Cirque du Soleil. And, you know, just
I heard that one.
All kinds of things, you know. I mean, honestly, my short list going to notes of things that have been reversed on. Let's see, there's Assad in Syria. There's NATO, China as currency manipulator. The competency, actually, of Trump's own intelligence apparatus, which he's really relying on, you know, as he drops
these bombs in places.
Yes, you have to rely on intelligence to say this is the right thing to do. So, I mean, there have been so many reversals. Mm-hmm. And the one with NATO, according to President Trump, is because they changed, not him. He said it was obsolete before. They changed. They are now addressing terrorism. He says this is the reason. And they're doing these payments now. And so it was they that changed, not him, when, in fact, the NATO alliance has been active in combating terrorism since 9/11. I mean, literally on 9/12, they started doing work on that. Their first military operation was less than 30 days after 9/11. So the idea that they changed is just, like, not right.
You know, it's like he's acknowledging that he owns these things now, you see. I mean, this is truly the transition from campaigning to governance, because now he is the commander-in-chief. So if he continues to be negative and bleak and talk down all this stuff, it's on him, right? I think that explains these very Pollyannish tweets also.
Sure.
That, you know, he's in charge, and so of course everything is going to work out fine, right? Didn't he say everything would work out fine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's explaining himself to a base of people, I think, who largely did not have an understanding of things. They got their understanding through him on the campaign trail. And so if he says, well, this has changed because I say so, well, the base says, well, it's because
But wait a minute. Don't you think his view has changed?
I think on some of these, yes, as he learns. I mean, it's like political fantasy camp. You know, you go into it and it's like, oh, this is how this works.
But Fred, the question I have for you is whether the people who loved the sort of doom and gloom Trump are going to stay with him as he paints this different picture and suddenly discovers that international norms matter and that alliances matter. And, you know, are they going to stay with him, or are they going to say, wait a minute, you promised America first, and now you're bombing Syria, you're bombing Afghanistan with massive new ordnance, you're changing?
Well, most will, but not all of them. There have been criticisms of Trump by some of at least the conservatives in journalism who have supported him and have criticized him, particularly for the bombing in Syria.
Yeah, but I think among his voting base, the only way he's going to lose those people, those people voted for him on two issues: the demonizing of immigrants, truly believe that wall, and jobs. Mm-hmm. So if he starts to fail on those two things, he's going to lose them. Otherwise, pretty much do what he wants. Listen to them. Everybody loves a good bombing.
I agree with that. You know, I forgot to ask one thing. I'm going back to Syria now. Mm-hmm. Why, Barbara, did the Trump and his UN ambassador, and I think Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State as well, have now all said, well, Assad doesn't have to step down?
You know, look, it gets bewildering. They have all, frankly, reverted to the Obama administration position, which is that in the long term, Assad cannot remain if there is going to be any semblance of a coherent government in Syria because of the atrocities that he's committed, like these chemical weapons attacks and the barrel bombs and the slaughter of 500,000 people on his watch. But as Tillerson said in Moscow, it has to be a process. You don't want what's left of the state to collapse. So the question is, can you extract Assad at some point and his cronies, his family, and still have a surviving Syrian state? Now, I don't think anybody knows.
What about this mother of all bombs that was dropped? I know you wanted to.
Yes, I was.
Talk about it. It was dropped in Afghanistan, on supposedly ISIS tunnels and so on.
It's the GBU-43, the Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, also known as the mother of all bombs. It's so big you have to push it out of a cargo plane with a drone and a parachute, and then it kind of turns and drops. Massive, massive. I think it had perhaps a legitimate use in Afghanistan, but again, it's a demonstration effect.
Yeah.
You know, if you're North Korea, if you're Iran, and you have underground facilities, you know, both of them do, it tells you the U.S. has something that could hit you if you are not careful. And Trump seems to enjoy dropping bombs. So, you know, let's be thankful it was in an area and a place where the consequences perhaps will be minimal in terms of a response.
Michael, what about this? One of the things about it is this was probably the safest place you could drop it without a lot of collateral damage.
Yeah, this is the question. Was this really tactical in terms of some sort of a military operation designed to incur losses and make a military advance? Or was this really a demonstration and a message sending? So Bashar al-Assad drops chemical weapons to make him send a message, and we drop a giant bomb to send a message, and then we have all this message sending. But at the end of the day, you set a coherent solution in Syria. It's not going to be achieved through dropping bombs of any kind by either side.
No, it's going to need diplomacy.
Right. You have to have boots on the ground. You have basically 13 well-armed street gangs in there right now, and that has to change. It's not going to happen through airstrikes.
Does Trump, is he relying more heavily on the military? And I mean it this way, that he agrees with them and relies on them more than, say, President Obama did.
Well, there's a downside. He seems to be giving extraordinary flexibility, to use a Trump word, to his commanders. And one of the strikes that was called in Syria killed 18 U.S.-backed rebels. There was enormous human loss, civilian loss of life in Iraq recently when U.S. struck a building in Mosul. So he doesn't seem to care very much about the civilian casualties that occur as a result of what appears to be, a lot more freedom of action for our commanders. So this is a double-edged kind of tactic.
I agree. The Obama administration rely a lot more on the drone strikes, the intelligence, and these sort of surgical taking out and beheading of the leadership of the organization. And I think now you see a lot more of the traditional type of saber rattling that would go on when you think it's a traditional, conventional military operation. But most assuredly, it is not. All of this can send a message. It can make a point. But that point is not a solution. You know, we still have to have a coherent strategy, and we still don't even know whether that's coming from the White House, from the State Department, from Nikki Haley over at the UN. We're not even sure where that strategy is going to come from.
And we have a lot of generals. We have a lot of generals, you know, in this administration. So that's another issue. Mm-hmm. Right?
Definitely. A lot of brass.
Yeah, Barbara, briefly, how would you, after we did, it's not quite 100 days, but assess the Trump foreign policy?
I'm still confused about what it is. The past few days, it was very Hillary-esque in my view. You know, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton would have been all that different, very tough, very hawkish sounding. I'm still waiting to see the diplomatic component. I'm very hopeful that at some point they will fill out the ranks of the State Department and really get engaged in the diplomacy side of things, because it's great to have military leverage. But if you don't have a diplomatic component, then, you know, you're not going to be able to make results in terms of resolving some of these conflicts.
Michael, same question.
Yeah, I think the development of a cohesive strategy, after we've seen this whiplash turns over the course of the last short term, we need to see what's going to be permanent, what's going to be the situation that we resolve and stick to, so that you can take a cohesive and lasting strategy to a group of partners, a group of allies, and say, here's what we're going to do. Because when you have a coalition like that, it will not survive, you know, these type of whiplash turns.
People need predictability
from month to month, much less week to week or moment to moment.
Is it safe to say that Trump is not an isolationist?
Not today. Stay tuned.
Barbara?
I still don't know what to make of the man. I really don't. I don't think we've ever seen his likes.
You're ducking the question.
I am ducking the question because I don't know what he believes.
I've never thought he was an isolationist. I'm not sure what he is, but he's not an isolationist. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, acting director of the Future of Iran Initiative and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.